you sure that this guy is even in the city?
Well, the latest information, as gathered and collated by the Interpol Computer Bank, would support this. He isn't comfortable in Europe. No one will hire him. Africa, Asia, the Middle East, South America. There's been enough revolutionaries. But if you wanted worldwide press coverage, New York, where else?
What about the possibility that he could have retired or gone into hiding?
Sergeant Fox, isn't it? The answer to the possibility of Wolfgar's retirement, sir, is he's only beginning.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. This is episode one. My name is Stu.
And I'm Hunter.
And thanks for coming back. If you are a return customer. Yeah, it's the words I'm looking for. Yep. Thanks, Hunter. Now, first off, we must explain about this episode. We are going to be a bit more rougher around the edges with this one due to some serious time constraints that myself and Hunter have got with our various family/relationships in our lives. We are recording this and hopefully plan to get it out in a couple of days. It will be up in a couple of days' time from the day of this recording because I am going away for 5 days with my family and you have got pretty much the same plans with your girlfriend.
Yes, that's true. And I put a post up on this about the website, so apologies if you read it already, but just in case you didn't get the memo.
Yeah,
exactly. It's just like, you know, you put a lot of post work into episode zero,
yep.
And I don't want people to think we're shirking our the duties here.
Oh, no,
with
no.
Episode one that, like, oh, we decided we ain't going to be doing that no more.
Yeah, we're just going to scale
it back. Not so. And plus, this topic we have is kind of fun and loose, and, you know, it's just not...
not feasible.
It's just not something that requires that level of work.
I mean, it could do it, but boy, you wouldn't be in this episode for about 3 weeks, and that, we're not going to leave it that long. It's just ridiculous,
right? Like, our next few shows, I think we'll have more bells and whistles. We've got our next few shows planned out.
Yes, we do,
and they're much more specific in nature. This is a very broad topic.
Yeah.
The name of this episode is The Overlooked Hotel, but we'll get to that in a moment. Stu, you had some things you wanted to clear up real quick.
Okay, I want to make an amendment to episode zero. I re-listened to the episode the other day and realized I'd made not a serious error, but it is an error nonetheless that needs to be addressed. When I was talking about the film Class of 1984 and in reference to its director, Mark L. Lester, I reeled off a bunch of films of his that he had done, and I said Rapid Fire, and I was wrong. He did not do Rapid Fire. That was Dwight H. Little. What I meant to say was he did Showdown in Little Tokyo, and I got my wires crossed.
Oh, I have seen Showdown in Little Tokyo. I said I hadn't seen any other Mark Lester movies, but I have seen that one.
There you go. I didn't even pick up on it.
So I made a mistake, too.
Yeah. But the thing was, I meant to say Showdown in Little Tokyo, and because they both had Brandon Lee, I got my wires crossed, and it's my bad. I apologize.
Forgivable mistake.
Yeah, I think
just for the best.
I think talking about Class 1984, I got myself so worked up, I just lost all sort of track of what I was really going on about.
Right.
But all fixed, all done. Okay.
All done.
So now, The Overlooked Hotel.
This episode is called The Overlooked Hotel. Sort of a study in the underscene, profiles in the underscene, if you will.
Films that are criminally underseen, more like they are. Well, really, really good films, but they just sort of...
Or sometimes they're films that just have a tiny audience, and if you're part of that audience, you may not have heard of them, and we'd like to share them with you.
That's right. Now, some of these films, we are going to give their DVD availability as we talk about them, or Hunter, right. You were saying...
Well, all of mine are or have been available on Region 1. There's one I know I'm pretty sure is out of print, but I'll get into its availability. But if it's available, if I have any notes on the film's availability, I will enlighten you as to them. But otherwise, just assume that they are available on Region 1. I know they're available on Region 1. As far as other regions go, I have no idea.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm sure if rings your bell enough, you'll do your own research.
Yeah,
so.
you'll go track it down by any means necessary, sort of.
That's we're movie fans. That's what we do.
That's right. And also, I am in sort of the same boat. I know I've got a couple in there that you do need to do some real digging around for. One in particular, you're going to have to really do some digging for. But when you get it, you will be highly rewarded with it. But and I will make specific notations on which ones they are when I get to them.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So do you want to go first or should I?
No, you started first last time, so you can start first this time again.
All right, then.
All right.
So my first film is one that sort of flew under the radar. It's a film directed by the actor Andy Garcia, and it's called The Lost City.
Okay.
And have you heard of it?
I have heard of it. I've never seen it.
It's got Andy Garcia in it. It's got Bill Murray. It's got Dustin Hoffman in a small role. And it's got Thomas Milan, who was in a ton of spaghetti westerns.
Yeah.
But the sort of premise behind it was, I think, one reason it sort of flew under the radar in Hollywood. It's a very lavish movie. It's got like you know, it's got really good production values, and it was written by a Cuban exile and who wrote the film Vanishing Point under a pseudonym.
All right.
But it's a film. I think the reason it wasn't too well accepted, or it didn't really find a big audience, is Hollywood is a very pro-Castro town, and The Lost City is about a family during the Cuban Revolution. And it's very it's kind of like The Godfather in that it's this big epic family drama.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas Milan is the head patriarch of this family, and his sons, one of them is played by Andy Garcia, and he owns a nightclub, and all he really cares about is music and the sort of musical culture of Cuba. And one of his sons is joining the Marxist revolutionaries.
Yep.
And, you know, so the family in a classic sense, the family gets divided over the winds of change in a country. But it's a very good movie. The Bill Murray plays this comedian that does stand up at Andy Garcia's club.
Yeah.
And Dustin Hoffman plays Meyer Lansky, the famous gangster. But I think the reason it didn't go anywhere in terms of an audience, it sort of stayed small and independent, was because of probably the politics of the film. It's not necessarily like a right-wing movie or anything, but it very much presents Castro and Che Guevara in a negative light.
Yep.
But it's an alternate viewpoint, you know, because a lot of movies we see in Hollywood, independent or otherwise, are very pro-Che, pro-Castro, pro-the current regime in Cuba.
Yeah.
And this movie's not. It's called The Lost City because it sort of looks at the culture that disappeared when Cuba was overtaken by the Marxists. So it's a movie. I put it on this list just because it was one of my favorite movies of the year it came out, which I think was 2006, and no one really saw it.
Yep.
But but it's one to seek out. If you like big family dramas, like Civil War dramas, family dramas like The Godfather, you'll find something to enjoy here.
Okay, good. I'll give it a look for sure.
Yeah, okay. It's really good.
Well, now, I should clear up first before I give any of mine out that I am a bit different than Hunter. I tend to give films quite a few years before I consider them truly overlooked classics, or classics right. In my eyes, anyways.
Well, I mean, I think the reason I included some, because some of the films on mine are quite recent.
Yeah.
But I think one reason I include somewhat recent films is that I feel like the film market today is so overcrowded and overstuffed. A lot of movies get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, that's well, and, you could say that about a lot of films, but I tend to give films, I'm going to say at least 10 years before I consider them truly overlooked and unseen.
Yeah.
Some find their audience 5 years.
Who knows?
Down
maybe
the track.
Maybe next year somebody will hold up The Lost City as some masterpiece that was overlooked. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, if a movie didn't find an audience and it still hasn't, I will put it on here. And
yep.
That's part of the reason, I guess, I discuss these more recent movies so they find an audience and don't become like old overlooked movies that no one's heard of.
Mm-hmm. No, I suppose that's a good point there.
But yeah, there are some older movies on mine, but a lot of them are actually newer. I was looking, there's one that came out last year. on here that just no one saw.
Oh, it's still, you've given it no time to blossom, boy.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah. Well, anyways.
That's all right.
Let's move on.
You say tomatoes, I tell you tomatoes. All right. First off for my one, well, these, I should emphasize, well, these are not in any particular order. I'm just reeling off ones that I've written down on my list. And whatever's written up there first is what comes first. And mine is a film, and I'm also going to state years as well these came out, just to sort of give you an idea of, you know, how old they are and how I've looked at, you know, the time, how cruel Father Time's been to these films, unfortunately. One of the ones I got that is a, it's actually one of the later titles from 1999, is a film called East is East.
I have not heard of East is East.
East is East is a British film. You know, I spoke in episode zero about Meantime and the my love for slice of life dramas. Well, East is East, yep, is another one. It's a bit more funny than Meantime is. It's still got very dramatic elements to it, but it's about a cultural clashes in Britain in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. It's dealing with a mixed ethnicity family. You've got a Pakistani father, a very strict Muslim Pakistani father, married to a British woman, and the story tells of this couple and their seven children. The seven children are divided between their Muslim faith forced down their throat by their father, and also growing up in early 70s Britain and adapting to the British lifestyle as well that they were born and raised in.
Huh. So another family divided movie. What a coincidence.
Another family divided movie, yeah. But, I mean, there's scenes where the kids are, you know, when the father's out, because the mother and father run a fish and chip shop over there, and the kids are out and they're sneaking bits of bacon and sausage, you know, pork, the forbidden food in the Muslim faith.
Yes.
And so it shows that sort of aspect of how they want to grow up, you know, very British, but with the...
They want to be like the kids they know that are their age.
That's exactly right, yeah. And so it centers as well on the... at the start of the film, there's an arranged marriage for the eldest son of this family to a Pakistani girl, and he doesn't want to go through with the wedding, and he ditches her at the altar, and the shame is brought upon the two families who are very close friends. And, it turns out the son actually is gay and is forced out of home and is considered dead. The father says, I've only got six kids, this my son is dead. He considers him dead for the shame, more for the shame he's brought, also for being a gay as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good little film. It's a good little film. The actual title comes from a Rudyard Kipling poem called The Ballad of East and West. East is East, West is West. And funnily enough, I was on IMDb the other night, and the sequel, West is West, is slated for a couple of weeks, for release in a couple of weeks' time.
So this movie was made when?
1999.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it is. It's over 10 years old.
Yep. It's one of the newer ones on my title. There's another one I've got there that's 9 years old, but I had to include it, and I'll bring it up later.
All right. Okay. Well, my next one is a movie, probably the most obscure movie on my list, and it's a film called Super Starlet AD.
I have never even heard of this thing.
If you're not from Memphis, chances are you haven't. Or if you're not a big Troma fan, chances are you haven't. This movie was actually – there's a bit of nepotism going on here. It's actually made by a friend of mine.
Okay.
I mentioned him on the episode I guested on for the Film Thugs. Guy named Mike Carthy.
Yes, I heard it the other day, yes.
Yeah, he made a little movie called The Sore Losers that had Guitar Wolf in it. But he did this movie called Super Starlet 80. He's done a bunch of really kind of crazy indie sort of drive-in exploitation style movies.
Oh, good.
And he is the godfather of independent Memphis filmmaking. He was the first guy in this area to pick up a camera and make a film. He made a movie called Teenage Tupelo.
And what's his name? What's this guy's name?
His name is John Michael McCarthy. Mike McCarthy is also – he also goes by Mike McCarthy, but a lot of his films you'll see John Michael McCarthy on
the credits,
on the poster. Okay. But Mike, he made a movie on Super 8, I think, called Teenage Tupelo. And Mike's adopted, and he made a movie about a girl who gets knocked up by a rockabilly singer.
Mm-hmm.
And she's being forced to give her baby up for adoption, but she joins this this gang of lesbian biker girls. It's pretty crazy. And then he also made a movie called Damn Zelvis, Daughter of Helvis that I've never seen. But Super Starlet AD is a movie he did. I'm not sure what year it came out, but I think it's been like 10 years or so. Mm. But it was put out by Troma. Troma picked it up and put it out on DVD. And basically the plot of this movie is pretty weird. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic future in a city called Femphis. And all men have devolved into Neanderthals. And all women have banded in. Women are the only you know, gender left, and they have banded together in tribes based on hair color. So there's the Satanas, which are the brunettes. Mm-hmm. There's the Tempestas, who are the redheads, and then there's the platinum blonde girls. And some of them ride around on horses with giant guns, but but since all gay men are dead, the fashion no longer exists, so they all run around in lingerie.
This stinks of Troma. This film.
Well, Troma did not make this film. They just distributed it.
It was right up there, Ellie, though.
Oh yeah, and these girls battle over lipstick and ammunition, but But there's this girl named Super Starlet AD who's like searching for her the stag films of her ancestors, and she and this other girl who are like have this forbidden romance because I think their hair colors are different. It's been a little while since I watched it, but they roam the ruins of Memphis looking for the stag films of their ancestors, and there's some pretty wacky musical numbers in it, and it's really kind of artsy, and it has this. It's kind of an art movie dressed up in exploitation clothes, which is kind of what Mike's movies are like. A lot of them are very sort of I don't want to use this word, but esoteric. I don't know. Yeah. They're very strange, but they have this sort of bizarre clothing that they wear. Like The Sore Losers is about punk rockers from outer space who come to Earth to eat hippies. Or kill hippies and eat them. Yeah, I think so. But they're only allowed to kill so many before they get stuck on Earth. It's really strange. And Guitar Wolf is in it. It's weird.
All right. I'm going to ask you one question.
Yeah.
Where the fuck do you find these movies?
Well,
I thought I watched some shit in my... Well, not shit. I should rephrase that. I thought I watched some weird stuff in my time. But my God, man.
Well, when you're friends with the guy who made the movie, that's sort of...
I suppose so, yeah.
He just made his first feature in a while. It's called Cigarette Girl, and it's not out yet for distribution. It's about this girl who it takes place in the future, and smoking is only relegated to sections of the city, and there's like the smoking section and the non-smoking section, and the smoking section is a really poor area. Yeah. And it's about this girl who's a cigarette girl at a club, and she quits smoking, but she's dealing cigarettes on the street outside of this evil club. She starts like killing people instead of smoking to get rid of the urge. Like there's this guy who's like the ghost of the Marlboro man that follows around. It's really crazy. It's a pretty rad movie though.
It sounds it.
It's probably the most straight film he's made though in terms of narrative. Like you can watch it and understand completely what's going on, whereas his other movies are very kind of out there.
Yeah.
But Super Starlet AD, it's out of print, but you can still get it pretty cheap. I got my copy off Amazon from some dealers.
Oh, okay.
And but it's also available on Netflix Instant, so.
Okay, good stuff.
So, it's a weird movie, but if you like sort of strange art house films and exploitation movies, it's sort of – Mike McCarthy really likes to roll those two elements together into a potent joint for you to smoke, so.
Hmm.
Yeah. Superstar.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to take us all the way back to 1982 with a film called Eating Raoul.
Eating Raoul. I've heard of this.
Okay. Paul Bartel.
What's it about?
All right. Well, it's about Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenoff playing a married couple named Paul and Mary, oddly enough. And they live in a very seedy apartment block. I don't know where it's set. I think it's set in California. I'm not entirely sure. But it's set inside a very seedy apartment block, and he's a he works in a liquor store, and he's trying to sell, $80 bottles of champagne to these street bums, and he's costing the company a fortune, that sort of stuff, and he loses his job in the end because he's blowing out the store's budget to guys who are pretty much after $2 chuck sort of bottle of wine. So he gets sacked, and he comes home one day and finds... and also, you got to understand that the apartment block they live in is infested with all these filthy swingers. There's a lot of swingers parties happening down the hall and a lot of noise and strobe lights coming out of there. So he comes home one day and finds a guy inside his house chasing his wife around, one of these swingers who's walked into the wrong house thinking that he was there for the party. And Paul Bartel goes over to the kitchen not knowing what to do and grabs a fry pan and... beats this guy to death with a fry pan over the head.
And so was the guy's name Raoul, and then they...
I'm getting to that. I'm getting to that. Anyway, so he's killed this guy, and they decide to take his wallet and find a stack of money inside there, and hit upon the idea that every swinger seems to be rich. Let's lure him to the house by getting the wife to dress up as a Nazi and all that sort of stuff, and lure rich swingers, kill them, and take the money, and invest the country restaurant that they've always wanted to run. Anyway, they get a guy who stumbles into their house one night by mistake, Raoul, who finds one of the dead bodies stuffed in a trash compactor or something like that. I can't remember exactly, or finds it on the floor, and splits a deal with them. If he gets rid of the dead bodies, he wants a cut of the restaurant. So he'll dispose of the bodies if he gets a cut of the money for the restaurant. And it's the grand scheme of things that happens later on in the film is just quite bizarre.
Yeah, I feel like I heard about this on a podcast or something, because this movie sounds crazy familiar to me.
Yeah.
I know I haven't seen it, but I've heard someone describe it in intimate detail.
It's a lot of fun. It's very, very funny. It sounds very dark and grisly, but it is a very, very funny movie.
So who did anybody I've heard of direct it? Or
Paul Bartel directed it.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Yeah. He's in it. Mary Warrenoff's in it. I can't think too many other people in it. Robert Beltran from Lone Wolf McQuade's in it as well. He plays Raoul.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a bonus as well. So
get a Chuck Norris connection there.
I'm doing it every episode.
Of course.
Yeah.
We can't go an episode without bringing up Chuck.
Like the Hollywood Saloon always drops a Star Wars, we're always dropping Chuck Norris.
Yes, Chuck Norris is to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast as Star Wars is to the Hollywood Saloon.
Exactly, yeah. Or Metropolis to Cinema Slave. Anyway, so that's Eating Raoul. one you've got to check out, please check out. It is very, very funny. It is available in region 1. I've got the region 4. And, yep, so the availability of that one is quite easy to get.
Okay, cool. Okay. Well, anyways... my next movie is actually one that's still sort of floating around, but I guess I put it on this list. It's the newest movie on here.
Yeah.
And I put it on this list mainly because I want people to see it and enjoy it. I've heard some people talk negatively about it, but I put it on here because I really liked it for the most part, and I'm just sort of trying to keep it from becoming overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Not that our audience is that big at this point, but...
we'll get there.
But... this is a movie called World's Greatest Dad, and
Robin
it stars
Williams.
Robin Williams. Yeah, mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
I've heard of it. I saw it in the store the other day when I was in there.
Yeah, and you hear the title "World's Greatest Dad," starring Robin Williams.
You think it's a piece of shit, like you?
Oh, it makes you want to like run for the hills, screaming like there's no way this movie is going to be good, but. When I saw it was directed by Bobcat Goldthwait, I decided it had to be worth checking out. And Bobcat Goldthwait's, a well-known comedian.
Yeah.
He's actually in a movie that's later on my list. But
let me ask you, why would Bobcat directing this film draw you closer to it?
because I saw a film he did called Sleeping Dogs Lie. It's also under the alternate title Stay. Uh-huh. And I thought it was a really good low-budget indie comedy. I don't want to get into that movie, but it's I thought it had a lot of kind of interest. I thought it had sort of an interesting commentary on relationships and certain people. It sort of goes against a lot of conventional wisdom.
Yep.
In terms of what people think is the right thing to do in a lot of situations. It's about somebody who has a really, really strange sexual secret in their closet.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when people want to know about it, it generally ruins the relationship. And so basically it's like, you know, a lot of people say honesty is the best policy, but
not necessarily
all the time. Okay. There are certain things, you know, some skeletons best
should stay in the closet. Exactly.
And that's Sleeping Dogs Lie, the titles. Yeah. And,
World's Greatest Dad. Now, is this a comedy or what?
Yeah, it's a dark comedy. It's about basically Robin Williams plays this poetry teacher, and he's the complete opposite of his character in Dead Poets Society. Yeah. I mean, he has like only a few students in his class. None of them give a shit about poetry, you know.
Yep.
And he wants to be a writer. He's written a bunch of novels, never been published. And he's, you know, thinking about giving up on writing. And in the meantime, he has this son who attends the school he teaches at, who is one of the worst people in the world. His son is played by Daryl Sabara.
Oh, our old sparring partner, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll know about it later on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's something coming that we mentioned him on.
Yeah.
But Daryl Sabara plays his son, and Daryl Sabara of Spy Kids fame. And he is just a complete shit. He's one of the worst people ever. He treats his best friend like dog shit. He treats his dad like crap. All he thinks about is porn and jerking off. And yeah, like, I mean, the movie opens with Robin Williams going into his room, and his son is sitting there like hanging forward with like a rope, and he's like, "Oh my god," you know. And then dad's like, "What are you doing, you queer?" And like, and he's like, and so he was, you know, he was doing a bit of autoerotic asphyxiation, and you know, so his son's got like, you know, issues, but
yeah, just a couple.
Just a couple. Well, what happens is, and he's dating one of the teachers at school, kind of incognito, and she's very beautiful, but she kind of jerks him around a little bit. You know, she's sort of a tease. She kind of leads him on.
Yep.
And, you know, she flirts a lot with this teacher who kind of looks like The Rock, who's like really dashing and handsome. And he's also, he also like gets published in the New Yorker on his first try. So he's like everything Robin Williams' character wishes he was.
Yeah.
But what happens is his son is choking himself and jerking off one night, and he dies.
Oh.
And Robin Williams wants to save him the humiliation of, you know,
how he died.
Of how he died. So he writes a suicide note and puts it in his son and hangs his son up in the closet, makes it look like he committed suicide.
Oh my god.
And basically, the suicide note leads people to believe that his son was a much more interesting person than he actually was.
Yeah.
So in order to protect his son's legacy, Robin Williams writes this – basically publishes his quote-unquote journal that he wrote himself.
Yeah.
And it basically makes his son look like this, you know, this troubled genius author. And so it's a good movie. It goes in a.
It sounds. The thing is, well, with me being a parent, it's going to be a tough watch.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. But it's an interesting movie though. Just about, because what the movie's ultimately about is the cult of suicide and death, and how, you know, when you've been in a situation where sort of we have a strange relationship with the dead in a community, mm-hmm. you know, we sort of like, cause you know, people get really attached to his son's memoir, and we see like different students around the school imagining his son, and they imagine their son as their own sort of idealized version of what he was like. Like, you know, the goth chick imagines him like cutting himself and, you know, with eye and wearing eyeliner and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's and people like, you know, they take his son to heart in a way that is nice.
It's fictitious.
But dishonest.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but it's a really dark, strange kind of comedy like that.
So would you say that Robin Williams' performance in this film is as manic as his one in One Hour Photo?
No, not at all. Okay. His performance is – he's really good in it. It's quite subdued. He's – you see, here's the thing is I loved Robin Williams when I was a kid.
Mm.
When I got older, I hated him. I couldn't stand him.
Yeah,
like Patch Adams.
And Toys and all sorts of stuff, yeah.
Toys. I think the Toys was where I started to see that the Emperor had no clothes.
Oh, yeah.
But when I was a kid, he was where it was at. I thought he was so funny, and I just loved him. And then, but also, like, I think his stand-up is extremely mean-spirited. I don't like his stand-up comedy at all. But but I don't know. In World's Greatest Dad, I really enjoyed Robin Williams again for the first time.
Robin Williams is an interesting one because he tends to make a flurry of shit and then he'll make the odd good one. Because back in the early 80s, he made The World According to Garp. Moscow on the Hudson was a very good film as well. He's very hot and cold. He'll also do Good Will Hunting. His performance in that was fantastic. And
oh, yeah. And so, a lot of people like him in 1 Hour Photo, too.
Yeah, I like 1 Hour Photo. That was quite good. Not the sort of thing I want to watch on a, you know... It's
kind of like a popcorn taxi driver almost.
Yeah, very MTV sort of taxi driver.
Yeah, and it's directed by Mark Romanek, so it's very music video director.
Exactly.
But I'm a fan. I'm one of the few, but I'm a fan of Popeye. So take that.
Popeye's all right. It's good.
It's a strange movie.
It is.
There's nothing
very weird movie indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
But yeah, so World's Greatest Dad, check it out. It's out on DVD in the States. I think it just came out in the cinema in the UK.
Okay.
So it's been out for a while here, though.
No worries. All right, well, I got one that's back to 1978, if my notes are correct. And this one may have been heard of, but it gets lost in the mix of this actor's profile. And that's one with Dustin Hoffman called Straight Time.
Straight Time, haven't seen it.
Okay.
It's the sequel to Mean Time.
No, it's not. Yep. Give that boy a prize. Okay, Straight Time is a based on the life of Eddie Bunker. You know who he is, don't you?
Eddie Bunker, yeah, sure. He's the guy in Reservoir Dogs.
Yep, Mr. Blue, who was a real-life convict and spent a considerable number of years in San Quentin. I think
he was in that documentary on Danny Trejo, too.
I think they may have even shared a cell. They were definitely in the same prison at the same time in San Quentin. But Eddie Bunker, this is based loosely. I don't know how much in particular is based on Eddie Bunker, but it's definitely based on him to a degree. And it's Dustin Hoffman, who's a burglar who's just been paroled. He gets out and he's trying to go straight. He's trying his hardest to go straight. He's trying to get a job, but he's got a real prick of a parole officer who one day he's in the car with and he beats the shit out of and gets rid of the parole officer and steals a car. And he's got a mate in Gary Busey who doesn't help matters at all. He just keeps pulling him back into this life of crime.
Well, you just sold me on this movie. I'm a fan of Gary.
Oh man,
Busey.
Well this one is a
particular
available.
Brand of insanity.
Oh, I mean this performance of Hoffman's is just, you know, it's so solid. It's see with Hoffman, he does some things really when he does them well. He does them really well, and when he makes wrong choices, they come off really bad. As in AKA Meet the Fockers and or what that Fockers. Sequel. He was in that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was in Meet the Fockers.
Yeah, he was in Meet the Fockers.
Sadly.
Yeah. But, in particular, performances that Hoffman pulled out, like Lenny back in the 70s, and especially this one in Straight Time, I just think are real gems that need
to be. Well, let's not forget Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, but that's so heavily lauded, that film, that, you know,
it's
not been lost at all. But Lenny, I feel
like. I'm just saying it because it's our namesake.
Yeah, we've got to drop that name as well. Huh? That and Chuck Norris every episode. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. But, with Lenny, that performance is, you know, I feel that it's a lost performance of Hoffman's, even though it's well known, but Straight Time is completely lost. If you give this title to people, I go, huh?
And I had the same reaction.
In my opinion, this film should be up there with the top films of the 70s, Taxi Driver and the Networks and all that sort of stuff.
Well, that statement alone, I have to see it.
You've got to watch this film.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yes, so Straight Time.
Straight Time.
Time to watch Straight Time. All right. So my next film, you're familiar with Stephen Chow, yes?
No.
Stephen Chow, he directed Shaolin Soccer, Kung Fu Hustle.
I've heard of Kung Fu Hustle.
You haven't seen these movies?
No.
Holy shit, okay. All right, anyways.
I need some schooling on it.
Okay. Well, so Stephen Chow he directed and starred in two of my favorite Hong Kong comedies, Shaolin Soccer, which is about Shaolin monks who form a soccer team and become like a really amazing kung fu soccer team.
Yep.
And it's really funny and wacky. And he did Kung Fu Hustle, which is sort of like a Shaw Brothers kung fu movie meets Looney Tunes. It is just off the chain.
Yeah.
Funny, like full of awesome action scenes and like just crazy physical comedy. We all know I'm a fan of physical comedy.
Yeah.
And then after that, he did a movie that, I mean, Shaolin Soccer found an audience in the U.S. Kung Fu Hustle got a fairly big release here. A lot of people have seen it. It's enough to where it's been double dipped on DVD. Mm. But and he's getting ready to remake Way of the Dragon, the Bruce Lee film.
Yep.
Chuck Norris's debut. But
yep.
He was going to direct the Green Hornet movie, but stepped out. But after Kung Fu Hustle, he did a movie here that pretty much no one saw called CJ7.
Oh, I've never
heard of that. Yeah, see? Yeah. It's and CJ7, I saw it recently, and it really spoke to me. I loved it. I think it may be his best film. It's a flawed film, but I think it might be his best movie. I think it's the best movie about people and their relationships with material objects. It's specifically about toys.
Yep.
It's about this boy. Oh, I'll get into the plot in a second, but I think it's the best movie about children and their relationship with toys, and by proxy, people and their relationship with material objects. What it's about is it's about this really poor boy in China. This is a Hong Kong movie.
Right.
It's about this really poor boy named Dickie who attends this prestigious private school. And his dad, played by Stephen Chow, who also directs and co-wrote, is, you know, a construction worker. He's a coolie is the term. He does, like, manual labor. And he spends every bit of his money that he earns on his son's education. Everything else they have, like, you know, he gleans from the garbage.
Yep.
So Dickie goes to school with all these really rich kids. And he's always there's this rich kid at school who has this toy robot dog.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always playing, and you know, so he thinks this thing is so cool. So one day he goes to the toy store. He wanders into the toy store, and his dad finds him in there. He's like, "What are you doing?" And he gets and he's like, "I really want this dog. All the kids at school have it." And he's like, "His dad's like, I can't afford it. I can't get it for you. I'm sorry."
Yeah.
And he goes, "If you get me this dog, I'll never ask for anything again." Well, we've heard that before.
Oh yeah.
And all parents have heard that line.
Yes, we have.
And he's just like, and he just says, "No, I'm sorry. I can't." And so his son's really upset. But when his dad is going through the garbage one day, and he finds something, a little strange ball in the garbage, and it looks like a toy, and he takes it home to his son, and the little ball turns into this. You find out that it's from outer space. You see a UFO take off, and it's this little thing that was left behind, and he gives it to his son, and it quickly turns into this alien toy robot dog from outer space. Oh my God. And so his son basically, it's a little CGI robot dog.
Yeah.
And it looks like a real creature. At first I was really confused. I thought that this was like a pet, but it's not, it's a toy.
Yeah.
And so there's the sequence in the movie that just blew my mind where the son, he goes to school the next day and he like, you know, takes the robot dog to an alley and he has it fight this like diseased rabid dog. And CJ7 is the name of the robot dog. And he beats the crap out of the rabid dog. And then he takes the CJ7 to school and before a test, he makes him these badass glasses that give him all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher like is like, let me see those glasses, and he throws the glasses at the teacher and they explode in his face. And then he's like, and he never has shoes for gym class. CJ7's like, I'll make you gym shoes, and he makes him these crazy rocket shoes, and they let him like swim really fast, and they let him jump really high, and like he jumps so high like there he like sees a cloud that looks like CJ7 and he's about to go down and, you know, he's basically like solves every problem in his life.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up and it's a dream. Oh. So these are the expectations he has for this toy. And when the toy can't do all these things, his reaction towards it is one of anger and spite, you know. And it's sort of like when you get this new toy or new gadget or something, you think it's going to be the answer to all your problems.
And after a week,
it's going to bring you happiness.
Yep.
It's going to bring you happiness, and that's just not realistic.
No.
You know, and he gets brought down to earth real quick. But it goes further than that. It has some issues, but overall, like, it really touched me by the end. But it has this commentary on our relationships with material things and, you know, the merits of it, but the pitfalls and, like, the way you just have to be realistic about things in life. But it's a really good movie.
See, the problem with that film sounds like it's going to be overshadowed by Toy Story 3.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I say it's the best movie about toys, I mean, the Toy Story films, they're great, but they sort of have a romantic view of children and their relationship with toys.
Yeah.
You know, like, I hear Toy Story 3 is a lot like, you know, Christopher Robin leaving Winnie the Pooh in the 40-acre yeah, in the
I'm too scared to watch in case I break down like a baby in the end.
That's whatever I've heard. That movie makes butter of grown men. But CJ7, I think it has a more interesting view of toys and our relationship with them whereas Toy Story 3 is kind of a storybook, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like CJ7, even though it has an alien robot dog and it has all this crazy physical comedy, I think it has a more grounded in reality view of toys and our relationship with them. But it's kind of a tearjerker too. It's really good.
Oh, good. Sounds interesting.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
Okay.
But well, I just mentioned it because it's the Stephen Chow movie that's available in the West that no one seems to have seen. So.
Oh, okay. Well,
anyways,
sticking with films from Hong Kong, and I'm going to give you one that you are seriously going to have to do some tracking down on DVD. I've got one from 1988 called Chicken and Duck Talk.
Chicken and Duck Talk?
Yeah.
Okay. No.
I gather you've never heard this.
No.
Not at all. Okay.
You're digging into the obscure, sir.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay, Chicken and Duck Talk is a film I watched on TV on the Foreign Channel many, many, many years ago. It's done by, oh God, I don't have a problem saying their last name, the Huey Brothers, H-U-I. If I've said it wrong and people listening in Hong Kong, I'm so sorry, my grammatical skills aren't the best at many times as it is. It's done by the Huey brothers, Ricky Michael, and I think Sammy's in there as well. I'm not sure, but it's definitely got Ricky and Michael Huey in there. And Michael Huey plays a guy called Old Huey, who's not really that old. He's probably about mid-40s.
Mm-hmm.
But he's referred to as Old Huey, and he runs a duck restaurant. And he's pretty much the only restaurant in the whole street. And he takes advantage of the fact that because he's the only restaurant in the whole street, he can have his shop filthy. That when the customers get their hot towels for their food, they're black and they're filthy, and there's cockroaches running around in the soup.
So he's the only game in town, so he doesn't have any incentive to bring up his game for the customers.
Yeah, clean. No, he is nothing like that.
Kind of like how Blockbuster treated their customers like shit here in the U.S.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But so he's the only, pretty much the only shop in the local area, and you know, there's cockroaches running around in the soup, and health inspectors are saying, "Look, there's a cockroach in the soup," and he pulls out and says, "No, it's a red date," and he eats it and says, "That's good for you." Yeah, he's it's got some really fucked up images in this film, but it's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I just laugh so hard, and I watched it again 2 nights ago. Yeah. Kind of in preparation for this, but kind of because I just wanted to watch it again. I hadn't seen it for a few months, or about a year. And so, anyway, across the road, after a little while, and he doesn't pay his workers much. He pays them a pittance, if anything at all. He's so cheap with his wife and his kid. They live upstairs, and the table's got 3.5 legs, and you know, it hasn't got 4 full legs on it, so it tilts to one side, and he won't put any lights on at night. He'll have the big neon light across the road shine into his room, and he'll read a book that way, and yeah, so he's a real miser. So anyway, across the road is a new chicken empire being built by this young entrepreneur who's, I think it's played by Ricky Huey. I might be wrong. I didn't read the cast list properly, so I sort of didn't prepare too well with that. But across the road is new chicken empire being built called Danny's Fried Chicken, which is based very much on American sort of themes, and a very westernized sort of restaurant. And
okay,
everybody starts flocking from old Huey's restaurant into the new fried chicken one, and even his own worker, who's had enough of it, goes and gets a job over there working as cashier attendant, and also works as a part-time chicken outside, handing out free vouchers and leaflets about the store. And so old Huey's trying to get all the people back into his restaurant. And it's just a struggle that comes about with him trying to take all the customers off Danny's Fried Chicken back into his own store. And
so he's got to step up his game. He's got to step his game up,
and he's got no idea how to do it because he's never had to do it before.
That's interesting. I like that. That sounds good.
And also,
but I guess this one's really tough to come by, huh?
It is. I'll try and throw a link up onto the site of where to get it. You are going to have to order it from Asia, I dare say. I think you can't even get it from... I know you definitely can't get it from North America, and I don't think you even get it from the UK at all. And it's definitely not over here.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those sort of interesting comedy dramas that like wouldn't find distribution in the West.
No, but over in Asia, the Huey brothers are very, very popular. They made a swag of films back in the 70s through the 80s. They did another one called Private Eyes, which was very funny as well. But, check it out. It's very funny. There is one sequence in the film. I'm not going to say what it is. Anybody who has seen it knows exactly what I'm talking about. It is so funny, and how it hasn't been ripped off by Hollywood, I've got no idea. And thankfully, it hasn't been ripped off by Hollywood, because they'd just fuck it right up. They would.
Yeah, don't ask for that.
No, I don't want to ask for it. Trust me. Yeah, so Chicken and Duck Talk. I'll try and get a link up onto the website for it, because you are going to have some struggles getting it, unless you've got a Chinatown or something in your area, like we do over here. You may have some luck there.
Okay.
Yep.
So my next one is a movie called Freaked. Have you heard of this one?
No.
Okay. Well, Freaked, it's a movie co-directed by Alex Winter and
Bill and Ted.
Yes. Alex Winter of Bill and Ted fame, Bill S. Preston himself.
I've heard of it now, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and he stars in it, but it's a movie he made. It's one of those films that got made at a studio, and it was sort of different and strange, and then the studio switched heads.
Yep.
And the new head didn't like the film and just buried it, you know?
Yeah.
And it just kind of went out on video, and no one saw it. Alex Winter stars in it, and it's he also co-directed it, and it's got makeup effects by Screaming Mad George, among others.
Oh, yeah.
And but it's a really wacky comedy, and it was just sort of Alex Winter off the heels of the success of the Bill and Ted films, kind of cashing in his chips.
Yeah.
And what it's about is Alex Winter plays this extremely arrogant former child actor. Yep. He's sort of a Corey Feldman type.
Yep.
Kind of, and he's, you know, getting hit up by this corporation called EES, the Everything Except Shoes Corporation. And he's being hit up to endorse their products, including a deadly toxic chemical called Zygrot 13. And so Alex Winter's character's name's Ricky Coogan, and he's telling the film's told in flashbacks as he's on a talk show with Brooke Shields. Yep. And he's apparently hideously deformed, and what happens is he goes down to South America to like do a press junket pushing this like deadly pesticide or whatever it is. It's some awful chemical that appears in things. Mm-hmm. And he ends up getting sidetracked with his buddy and goes to this freak show that's held by this wacky carnival circus ringleader. I don't know what the word is. He's played by Randy Quaid. That's yep. pretty much all you need to know.
Yeah.
And he presides over, and he basically kidnaps Ricky and his friends and turns them into freaks. He combines there's this guy and this girl, and they get turned into like, you know, Siamese twins, and Ricky gets turned into like a half man, half like monster. Yep. Like the beat, it's called the Beast Boy or something. And there's all a bunch of other freaks, like Mr. T plays the bearded lady. And
now I'm watching this for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, Bobcat Goldthwait plays a guy named Sockhead, and his head is basically a sock puppet. But you know, but his sock gets pulled off, and you see it's just another hand. And people are like, "Hey, he's not a sockhead!" And they start like pelting him with shit. and in an uncredited role, Keanu Reeves plays Ortiz the dog boy.
I thought you were gonna say Keanu Reeves. Yeah.
Yeah, Keanu Reeves is in it. His agent begged him not to take credit, and so Keanu Reeves is uncredited, but he plays the dog boy, and you know, and he's covered, he's unrecognizable, he's covered, if you really listen, he kind of has a Spanish accent.
Yeah,
he's like, "I am Ortiz the dog boy, shake, you know." He's unrecognizable, but there's just all these really bizarre comic set pieces. It's not like a particularly well-made movie, but I laugh myself stupid the whole way through.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's hard. There's a lot of physical comedy in it, but it's kind of hard to describe but I guess I could just give you a few little brief bits. Like, the Randy Quaid's evil circus freak show owner has a couple of enforcers, two giant pot smoking Rastafarian eyeballs named I and I. They're these giant eyeballs that are like Rastaman, and they're shooting at everything with Uzis. But, and William Sadler is the head of the evil corporation.
enough. I've got to see this.
It's like any comedy. You can't really describe it. All I can say is it's a gem. Go seek it out. I got my copy at Borders for like $10. It's out from Anchor Bay in a really nice deluxe set. But it's just one of those films like that has a small cult following because of VHS, but that's about it. But it's really funny. If you like the Bill and Ted movies, see this, because I think it's way funnier than the Bill and Ted movies.
Okay, and what year is this made?
1993.
Oh, 93, so it's that old. It's at least nearly 20 years old then.
Yeah, it's pretty old. It's older than I thought it was, I guess.
Well, good.
But it's so much fun. I would, if you just want to like throw on a movie to watch with your friends and laugh, it's hard to go wrong with it.
So it's definitely a film where you drink with your buddies, all right?
Definitely.
All right. Nice. I will track it down. Next one I want to bring up is one, it might have been so much overlooked that it is overshadowed. And I'm going to do that with a couple in here. And I was wrestling back and forth whether to put them in because they are more overshadowed and overlooked. But I think they go both hand in hand, overshadowed and overlooked. And that is a Sylvester Stallone film from 1981 called Nighthawks.
I've never seen that. I'm a Stallone fan. I've never...
You've heard of it?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, Nighthawks with Billy Dee Williams and Rutger Hauer also.
But this is early Sylvester Stallone then.
Well, it's 81, so it's, you know...
Yeah.
Not too. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's what 30 years old. So yeah, I suppose you can call it, yeah, fairly old. But the thing is, I feel this film was overlooked because you've had Rocky, then you had Rocky 2 in 79, I believe it was, and you had Rocky 3 coming in 82, and this film got lost in between the shuffle of the Rocky 2 and Rocky 3.
Yeah, it sounds like Stallone was in a few movies in between his Rocky films that no one saw, like Fist. Did you ever see Fist?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Fist is fantastic.
Fist is an awesome movie. It gets overlooked, but it's a good, like, Joe Esterhaus wrote the script. It's a good flick.
I nearly put Fist in here for Nighthawks, but I couldn't go past Nighthawks. I think
Fist is a good one. It's not on my list, but I would recommend that. That's one to seek out if you like Rocky.
Most certainly.
It's like Rocky if Rocky turned out to be less likable.
Yes. But Nighthawks, anyway, deals with two New York City cops, Stallone and Billy Dee Williams, who are assigned to a special anti-terrorism unit at the same time, a well-known international terrorist, Rucker Hauer, is in town, and it's a real cat-and-mouse thriller. I mean, a real, edgy-seat thriller.
Yeah.
And Rucker Hauer is also well-known for his, a man of a thousand faces sort of persona. He's always changing his looks. I don't know what exactly he looks like. And
oh, cool. Yeah, I love Rutger Hauer, especially.
Oh, man,
you've
got to see this film. It's just, it'll... Yeah. And the ending as well. I mean, those of you who have seen the film and know the ending, I'm not going to give it away, but it'll blow you out of your fucking seat. It's that good.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a fan of buddy cop movies. I'm a fan of Billy Dee Williams. I'm a fan of Stallone. I'm a fan of Rutger Hauer. This sounds like my cup of tea right here.
Oh, yeah. But these aren't really the buddy cop movies like your Lethal Weapon and the banter between Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. These two hard motherfuckers.
It's not even Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy.
No, not at all. No, these are some hard motherfuckers. Fucking
okay.
Stallone and Billy Dee Williams. Two guys you don't want to mess with at all.
Oh, nice.
All right. So that's Nighthawks.
Sounds good.
And that is available, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to check that one out. All right. So mine, next one, and this one is especially fun if you're a Bruce Lee fan.
I am.
And it's called Finishing the Game. Have you heard of this one?
No.
Okay.
Where the fuck are you getting these movies from?
I could ask you the same thing.
Come on, man. Nighthawks at least is fucking known somewhere. I'm Finishing the Game? All right. Talk.
Hey, this show is about overlooked and overshadowed.
Overlooked? I mean fucking 6 feet underground.
Okay,
shit,
so
I've never heard of this.
This movie's not that old. It's just a few years old, I think. It's basically a mockumentary. And it's directed by Justin Lin. So it's real independent, real low budget.
Yeah.
It was directed by Justin Lin, who did he's a strange director. He does some like small independent movies like this and Better Luck Tomorrow. But then he'll do like big Hollywood movies everyone hates, like Fast and Furious, Tokyo Drift. So what happened so this movie, Finishing the Game, is a mockumentary about a bunch of filmmakers trying to finish the movie Game of Death after Bruce Lee died.
Ah, yes.
And it's basically the first aborted attempt. Like, it's this, like, you know, Robert Klaus isn't a character in this. It's basically about this young filmmaker who's like, you know, he's going to finish Game of Death. And there's the cast, and it's mainly centers around the casting call to find the dude to replace Bruce Lee. And it's a brilliant movie. I mean, brilliant. I don't want to talk it up too much, but it's about, I mean, like, you know, kung fu film fans, we all know the history behind Game of Death and how all that happened, and this is just supposed to be like
a what if.
It's not even a what if. It's like, oh, this is the first attempt to finish it before we got what we got. And there's a bunch of different actors going after the part that we follow.
Mm-hmm.
And one is this guy named Breeze Liu, and he's in a bunch of like bad Bruceploitation movies. Like, you know, he's supposed to be kind of a parody of the guys who are in Bruceploitation movies.
Yeah,
like
Bruce Lai and Bruce Lai.
Bruce Lai.
Yeah.
Bruce Liu. His name's Breeze Liu. And one of them is like this guy who was in a 70s cop show with James Franco, and he was like one of the he was kind of going somewhere as an actor. But then James Franco's character, like, dies of a drug overdose while, you know, praying to Satan in a KKK outfit or something. And so he loses the job on the – like, since his co-star's dead, the show's over. And he's trying to find roles, but he just can't. And, you know, another one is this white guy whose mother's Chinese. And he's kind of one of those guys who's confused as to his ethnic identity. Like, he considers himself to be a Chinese person. And he goes to, like, beat poet readings where he's – where, like, there are a lot of Chinese people. And he's like, I see you, white man, staring at me. Railroad worker.
Yeah.
Railroad worker. And
a real identity problem. Yeah.
And like one is, you know, and then, but so we have all these different actors, and they're, a lot of them are totally not suited to the role. Yeah. And it's just about the, and Sherry O'Terry's in it, and MC Hammer has a really hilarious part as an agent for. He represents colored people, and he has this really offensive way that he approaches his clientele. But if you're a fan of Bruce Lee, and it's one of those movies that really kind of examines the role of Asian people in Hollywood.
Yeah, stereotypes.
Totally. Like it just kind of shows that, like, you know, Bruce Lee smashed open doors for Asians in Western film.
Yeah.
But he smashed them open and then he died.
And the doors got shut again, yeah.
The doors got shut again, and that's what kind of what it's about is there were doors open, but these doors are doors to sort of empty rooms. Like, you know, now instead of being like Mickey, Asian people being represented like Mickey Rooney and Breakfast at Tiffany's, they all know Kung Fu. They're all like,
yeah,
you know, disposable action men, you know, or, and it's just sort of about their role in Hollywood at the time versus, and how it hasn't really changed. And I think that's interesting because, you know,
but don't you find an actor like Chow Yun-fat has sort of broken those barriers down?
Chow Yun-fat's really not that big of a star in Hollywood. He's been in a few things, but he's still – we don't see him in, like, dramatic roles. We see him in action movies, you know?
Yeah,
like,
but that's Hollywood.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragons, and it's considered a foreign film, you know?
Bloody good movie, though.
Yeah, it is. But I'm just saying, like, you know, you don't see a lot of Asian actors who get –
romantic
beyond
men, yeah.
You don't see them as anything beyond the math geek or the guy who knows kung fu or and fights really well. I mean, they're just sort of relegated and stuffed in these boxes.
Yeah, pigeonholed.
You know, they're pigeonholed, and you know, it's just it's rare that they're presented as anything else. And so it's just sort of it's a movie about that. But if you're a fan of Bruce Lee, if you're a fan of 70s movies, if you're a fan of exploitation and stuff like that, it's just sort of a fun look at the racial politics in Hollywood, but it doesn't hit you over the head with it at all.
Yeah.
It's really...
It highlights them for you.
It highlights it. Oh, and it's also got Sam Bottoms in it, Lance from Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
But it doesn't hit you over the head with it. It's just kind of there, and you see it.
All right, great.
So, Finishing the Game... awesome movie. It's out on DVD. Check it out.
Good stuff. All right. I'm going to go all the way back to 1968 and a couple of big names in Hollywood, or have been big names in Hollywood for many, many decades, really. Pretty much their first film together, and that's Brian De Palma and Robert De Niro's Greetings.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of this movie.
Okay, well...
they did a bunch of movies together before either of them were famous, like like The Wedding Party, Hi Mom.
Hi Mom is a sequel to Greetings.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yes, and The Wedding Party is just...
it's before Brian De Palma decided that he was Hitchcock Jr.
Oh, yes, before Sisters and all that sort of stuff came out, yeah. But it's a really... how am I going to describe Greetings? Well, first off, it's about three guys... three completely different personalities. One is a conspiracy nut. That's the character portrayed by Jerrod Graham. One is a, looking for love, but not having much luck. I can't remember the actor's name. I can't remember. And Robert De Niro's character is a guy named John Rubin, who is a amateur filmmaker and Peeping Tom. Mm. Yes, and he peeps on women through the window and films them and all sort of stuff. And it's Greetings is really hard to sort of sum up in a few words.
Mm-hmm.
It's very it deals with the Vietnam War and it deals with draft dodging and deals with amateur
subjects that were very much of the time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see films these days about the Vietnam War and the anti-stance against it, and you think, but Greetings back in its day, back in 68, probably would have been a little powerful little film back then.
Yeah.
These days, it's very, very dated. And
yeah, because De Palma was making these movies that kind of thumbed their nose at the establishment before he kind of got his Hitchcock hard on, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. But, I mean, same with High Mom. High Mom is even more surreal. It has its moments. It has the sequence in there, Big Black Baby, where a group of white people paint themselves black and sort of turn the tables on white people, saying about all the racial stereotypes about what black people are perceived to be. They paint themselves black to, throw their perception of what black people think of white people and really turn the tables on them and freak these white people out. Something horrid. Yeah, I mean, Greetings is a real... I want people to see it, but you're not necessarily going to really like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
I mean, because I've heard some people say it's horrible, but I feel like it's... They say it's that because it's kind of rough around the edges, maybe?
Oh, it's very rough, yeah. I mean, the editing looks like it's been done with a pair of scissors and some sticky tape.
I mean, because... Yeah, because, like, De Palma's early movies, like The Wedding Party, were very independent.
Oh, that was shocking. That was terrible.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you can get that one from Troma.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I bought the VHS for about a dollar somewhere. I can't remember. And still felt ripped off after that. It was awful.
I've never seen it. I've never really felt the urge to.
But Greetings is available definitely in North America. I think it's a public domain film now, even.
Yeah, I've seen it on some public domain DVDs.
Yeah, because it's out there for, $2 or something like that. And pick it up. Look, if it was, it's going to become a beer coaster in the end. But it is a good little film. It's probably the strangest title I've got on my list. And that was one of the ones I was toying with at the most. I thought, do I put it in? It's that obscure and... Well, not really obscure, but, I mean, it's... Yeah, I'm not going to rattle too much about Greetings. It's... Just watch it.
Okay.
That's all I can say. Just watch it. You are either going to hate it, and you're going to think, oh, you're a fucking idiot, Stu, but... Or you're going to think... Thanks for turning me onto it. There's no real middle ground with Greetings. It's either you hate it or you really like it. I really like it.
Yeah, I've never seen any pre-Sisters De Palma, so I should definitely check it out.
Oh, give it a watch. But watch Greetings first, but if you're going to watch High Mom.
Okay. Because I see High Mom at the store all the time, but it's good to know it's a sequel.
Yeah.
So I can see Greetings first.
High Mom might make any sense if you haven't seen Greetings.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. All right.
Okay. All right, well, my next one is a double feature. I'm putting two movies together here.
Doing much?
Because I don't have a whole lot to say about either, but they both very much complement each other, and that is Duel to the Death and Five Element Ninjas. And
I've heard of Duel to the Death.
Five Element Ninjas is also known under its alternate title, Chinese Super Ninjas.
No.
And but you can find it on Region 1 DVD on an official release under the name Five Element Ninjas. But both of them are ninja movies, as you might have guessed. They're both Hong Kong films. Five Element Ninjas is it's a Shaw Brothers film. And whereas Duel to the Death kind of came a little bit later. Duel to the Death is directed by Ching Su Tong, who did the fight choreography for movies like Hero.
Oh, yeah.
And he's directed some other movies like The Empress and The Warriors. And Duel to the Death, it's basically about this Chinese swordsman and this Japanese swordsman, and they are like the best in the land. You know, they both represent, they're they're both the masters of their country, and every few years the greatest swordsmen in both countries meet it in this secluded location, and they have a duel to the death. Mm-hmm. And it's about these two swordsmen, and they're both on a path to meet each other and duke it out. And along the way, there's a lot of crazy ninja action. Like, yeah. And when I say crazy, I mean crazy. The action in this movie is so visceral and bloody. It just like hits you hard, and it just makes your eyes pop out of your head.
Yeah.
And there's a sequence where this monk is walking through this desert, and then the ground starts shaking, and he looks up and he sees this giant ninja. Like, it's a giant ninja walking towards him. Mm-hmm. And then it bursts into like five smaller ninjas, and he starts fighting them, and then they all reveal themselves to be this ninja woman who's completely naked, and he like looks at her like, huh? And then, like, you know, she's distracted him, and she does her move and, you know, takes mm-hmm. him out. But but the ninja scenes in it are just breathtaking. I can't really say too much more than that. And it's also a really good film in that, like, it does a good job of building up both of the characters.
Yep.
Like, you don't necessarily root for – it's a Chinese film, but it doesn't force you to root for the Chinese swordsman. Yep. They build both characters very well, and you end up caring enough about both of them that it's really hard when it finally comes time for them to face each other. Yeah. Because you're not really behind one of them more than the other, so it makes it kind of the final battle more interesting.
So it really is a duel to the death.
Yeah, it really is a duel to the death. Last man standing. Wow. And the whole movie's building towards it, but the build-up involves – it's a pretty short movie. It's like 80-something minutes, but it's paced really well.
Yeah.
It's got lots of great – it's not like action-packed, but the action that's in it is just like mind-blowing. It's awesome.
Wow.
And Five Element Ninjas is a bit older. It's a Shaw Brothers film. And it's directed by Chang Che, probably my favorite Shaw Brothers director.
Yep.
Him and Lau Kar Leung are my two favorite. We're going to talk about Chang Che next week.
Yes.
Next show.
Yeah.
But so Five Element Ninjas is about this evil – these two schools of martial arts. And the one of them employs this dastardly group of Japanese ninjas and puts them through this gauntlet where they have to fight these elemental ninjas. Yep. One of them's the light ninjas. I guess they all dress in gold, and they have these gold reflector shields, and they use the sun to blind their enemies and take them out. Mm-hmm. And then there's the wood ninjas that hide in trees and pop out, like, you know, one of the warriors will get next to a tree and this hand will pop out and, like, you know, scratch his stomach open or something. And, like, oh, there's a great bit where they figure out one of the ninjas is in this tree, and these four guys throw their these blades on the end of a chain at them.
Yep.
And they get each of his arms and legs, and they pull him out and they rip him apart. but it's really, like, cartoony and strange and funny. Yeah. But and then there's, like, the water ninjas, and these are the goofiest looking guys. They, like, come at you, like, on these little floaty things and come at you with, like, little bamboo reed pipes, and they jump out of the water, but it's always, like, in reverse motion. So it's like they had the actors jump in the water backwards.
And
so it looks like they're leaping out, but they're, of course, the splash is reversed and they're completely dry. But it's corny as all hell. And then there's the fire ninjas.
Yep.
And they use, like, a lot of smoke and fire techniques. And then there's my favorite, the earth ninjas. And they attack from underground. And they have – it's just funny. Like, a warrior will be fighting someone, and then this little spear will just come out of the ground and stab him in the thigh. And he's just like, ah! But if you watch this movie, watch it with the dub, the English dub. Because the English dub is freaking awesome.
Yeah, I'm not a real fan of English dubs. I hate them.
I'm not either, but in this case, it's enhancement, sir. Like, here's an example of a line. Like, the master of the school has been poisoned by the Japanese clan. He goes, "I have been poisoned. I can't use kung fu for about 3 months."
Yeah, see, to me, that's...
go ahead.
Yeah, to me, that sounds... it's a novelty after a while. It gets really, really tired. I mean, I used to watch, for instance, I used to watch all the Bruce Lee films with the English dub. It's the only version I had with the VHSs.
Mm-hmm.
I then got the big Bruce Lee box set, and it had the original, oh, God, forgive me if I'm wrong, Cantonese or Mandarin? I think it's Cantonese.
Yeah, they sort of switch them up a lot.
Yeah. So anyway, I'll say Cantonese for argument's sake. So I started listening to the original Cantonese with the subtitles, and it just made so much more sense. I thought, I can't go back to the English dubs no more.
No, I completely understand that. Like, with a Bruce Lee movie, I want to watch it with the subtitles and everything.
Yes.
But this movie is so camp and so crazy.
That the English dub complements.
In the English dub, the dialogue is hilarious. Like, 10 rounds of combat will easily decide this matter between us. You know, gems, sir. It's enhancement. It makes the movie, like, even more cartoony and even more bizarre than it otherwise would be. And they all talk like this. You know, it's just it's just too much fun. Like, and watching it with the dub on is – it just amps up the fun factor by 10.
You know what killed it for me with the English dubs was when I watched the English dub of Hardboiled. I just
– oh, yeah. The English dub of The Killer is pretty priceless. Mickey Mouse, hey, Donald Duck, you know. It's just but lots of choices.
The English dub of Hardboiled was just rancid. And I just swore never again after that.
Most English dubs are rotten to the core, but this is an exception to the rule. Trust me. Yeah, Five Element Ninjas, watch it with the dub. It's the only way to watch it.
I will do that.
All right, so that's my two, Duel to the Death and Five Element Ninjas.
Okay, well, the next one, I had a tough time putting this in the list because it's people are going to scream fanboy when I say it. it's not it's not Chuck Norris. Don't worry, it's nothing like that. Or Black
Spot. Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. This was made by a friend of mine and yours, Hunter, and you may know of this film. It's one half of the Hollywood Saloon, John Jansen's Mainly Etc.
Okay, I've never seen it, but I know what you're talking about.
Okay. This is probably the one – well, this is the one film on my list you are going to have to really do some searching for. In fact –
well, I'm not going to because you're a fucking fanboy.
Well, I told you that. I warned you, sir, didn't I?
I'm just kidding.
I know.
No, I've always wanted to see this movie. I remember Joe Barlow talking about it on his podcast, and it sounds really good.
It is. I mean, it's hard for me to talk John up because, you know, he's a guy I've corresponded with quite a few times. And
John's been great to me. I mean, he
– oh, yeah.
He's the – before Hearts of Darkness came out on DVD, he hooked me up with a copy of it.
Yeah.
He hooked me up with a copy of Razorback. He hooked me up with a copy – a DVD full of Russell Mulcahy music videos.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the guy is his generosity.
He's a very generous man. Let me just state that for the fact.
He's infinite. I mean, he is.
He hooked me up with a copy of The Keep as well in widescreen.
Oh,
yeah.
Jealous.
With all the extra features as well that he's. I don't know if he's done the extra features, but I'm guessing he's done all the extra features with like the 20 minutes.
I haven't even seen The Keep. I've always wanted to.
It's a strange fucking movie. Mainly Etc. I put in there because I got the copy from John Jansen from the Hollywood Saloon and put it in, and you have to understand this was filmed with a digital video camera with a budget of $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear that, you think, wow, this is going to be a shocker. But let me tell you now that this film looks like it's been shot for about maybe $60,000, if not $100,000. The editing and the shot, there is one shot John does, which is, I know he did it because he's the only cameraman on the whole feature.
He's like Michael Mann.
He's from the school of Michael Mann knowledge, I'm sure. Everyone knows that who knows John. But
yeah,
there's one.
He's a Michael Mann fan.
He's a fanboy.
With two N's.
Yeah. So anyway, there's one shot that he does where a guy runs from his campus and there's all these papers flying in the air and John must have been lying on the ground literally. Well, he was. He was lying on the ground, and this guy runs over the camera. It's hard to explain, but when you see this shot, you just go, wow, there's a guy who knows how to set a shot, who knows how to frame a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's if there's anything I've got to gripe about with this, which I shouldn't be doing this, but if I'm just letting people know, it's probably the audio is a little bit down in the mix, but what you get visually, you are rewarded highly. It's fantastic.
If a film is told competently visually, dialogue is almost like second.
It's quite an astounding. For $3,000, it's quite astounding, really. And you know what? The acting in it is fairly good. I mean, for what you get, you got no name actors at all. I mean, this film is a true independent film, not like films you get with fucking Tom Hanks and
it's like Little Miss Sunshine with Steve Carell, the biggest comedy star in the America, and your little independent
film. That is not an independent film.
Exactly, but we're meant to think it is.
Charlie Wilson's War is not an independent film. Fuck off, you are not independent. Mainly Etc. is a true independent film.
Right. It's as independent as they get.
Yep, everything's done from the ground up.
If you want to see Mainly Etc., you will have to go find it. It will not come to you.
No, don't go looking for it in your bricks and mortar stores. Don't even go looking for it on your Netflix rentals. It won't be there. You've got to contact John, and
you got to go straight to the filmmaker for this one. And
he's probably going to kill me now for everybody going, John, can I have a copy of Mainly Etc.? John, can I have a copy of Mainly Etc.? He's going to be going, fucking going to send me broke. Sending all these copies out. Sure,
I think John's the kind of guy who's more than happy to share his creation with anyone.
I've got quite a few of his films that he's sent out to me, been kind enough to send out. There was one he did for his high school. I think it was his 20-year anniversary for his high school, called Falcon 86. And, boy, I tell you what, I live here in Australia, and I tell you what, watching this video, it's a video scrapbook of his years at his high school from the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's interspersed with old commercials from the 80s and beer commercials and music videos and MTV bits. And you'd swear you actually went to that school. You swear you were actually a student at that school. And I live in another country altogether, and I felt like that. But
wow.
But Mainly Etc., check it out. You will be rewarded. Don't be put off by the fact that it was only a $3,000 budget film and it's done with a digital video camera. You will be.
If anything, that's the kind of movie you should want to seek out.
You should be seeking out. That's why you're listening probably to this podcast, because we're not going to be promoting films like Film X or what, you know, whatever's out the cinemas now. We don't give a
fuck. You know, we're not going to. We're a lot of with podcasts. I think part of the fun of podcasts is finding out about movies you haven't heard of.
Exactly.
And or maybe you weren't before interested in seeing, and now you're. And now you're like,
your interest maybe peaked a bit.
Yeah, exactly. So, if low budget, I'm sure people listening to this have seen El Mariachi. That was for $7,000. Exactly. It's a pretty good flick. So,
my word, it is.
Primer, $7,000. Great flick. You know.
Yeah. All right. Hannah. Okay. Over to you.
All right. My next one is a movie directed by Paul Schrader, and it's called Mishima: A Life in Four Chapters.
I nearly had a Paul Schrader film on my list, and I had to excise it, and that was Blue Collar. But go on.
Oh, yeah. Mishima is a film about the life and art of Yukio Mishima, a Japanese poet, author, playwright, filmmaker, photographer, basically all-around Renaissance man.
A true story.
If there was an art form, Yukio Mishima dabbled in it. He was in the film Mishima is played by Ken Ogata. He was in films like Vengeance Is Mine, the Shohei Imamura film. Mm-hmm. And basically Yukio Mishima, the movie opens with him. Mishima has on his estate, and he has his own private army. And Mishima goes with his private army to meet with a Japanese general, in the Japanese military at this point, this is post World War II. So this is a 20th century author, but this is post World War II. So the Japanese military is quite weak, but he goes to meet with this general and ends up taking him hostage and with his private army. And he demands that the army meet out front for him to give a speech. And this is not spoiling anything. This is history right here. But Mishima gave this speech, basically saying how, you know, Japanese spirit has been crushed, and, you know, the Japanese have become weak and too westernized. and how they must embrace their spirit, and the audience doesn't take him seriously, so Mishima commits harakiri and commits suicide.
Yep.
And the film uses this as a framing device. It opens with him, you know, with his army going to the facility, and then we get his childhood and these flashbacks. And the movie basically intersperses the day of Mishima's death with events from his life with four of his plays.
Yeah.
So we get four of Mishima's stories. So it's like the best – it's one of the best biopics I've ever seen, because you get basically this person's life, death, and art all rolled into one package. And Mishima,
now,
like
– with this film – sorry, mate.
No, go
with,
ahead.
With this film, you said it was – you just mentioned biopic, and that got me thinking. Does the actor – playing this character resemble the real life character in looks? Because that's a real sticking point with me. If I've got to try and imagine Willem Dafoe playing James Dean, you know, it ain't going to happen. As good as an actor as Dafoe is, it's not going to happen.
If you imagine him playing who?
James Dean.
Oh, did he play James Dean?
I'm just using it as an example.
Okay.
Yeah, meathead.
So you like your actor, you like them to look like...
well, in for instance, for instance, Val Kilmer in The Doors. He resembled Jim Morrison a fair bit, in my eyes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, no, Ken Ogata does look a lot like Mishima.
Okay.
He's very he kind of has a similar bone structure, but Mishima is a really interesting guy. I mean, he was a writer and a poet and an intellectual, but he also like placed severe importance on physical fitness. Like he said, a lot of intellectuals at the time shirked that and didn't, you know, they only kept their brain sharp, but Mishima also was very keen on keeping his body as strong as his mind.
Yep.
And he was very right wing as far as Japanese politics goes.
Yep.
So he's sort of a controversial figure, but he is one of the nation's great authors. And Paul Schrader wrote and directed it, and Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas produced it. And it's got a score by Philip Glass that is just amazing.
Jesus.
But it's not a movie that really got much recognition. It didn't gather much of an audience, but Criterion put it out on DVD recently. And also you can get Criterion also put out on the same day Mishima's a short film Mishima made called Patriotism that he wrote, directed, and starred in.
Oh, okay.
So you get the life of Mishima, and you can also see some of his art as well. But it adapts some of Mishima's plays and his life, and it's just a really good, interesting movie. And everyone I've shown it to just falls in love with it.
Great.
So yeah, Mishima, Life in Four Chapters. Go see it now.
I will do that. All right, my next one is another one I feel is overshadowed. Well, it definitely is overshadowed, and overshadowed for a few reasons. It came in a period of this director's career when things were starting to drop a bit, even though he'd had a lot of success, or no more than 5 or 6 years earlier, with a couple of films he did, and in particular, this film was overshadowed by a little film in 1977 called Star Wars. And this one I'm bringing up is Sorcerer.
I was immediately thinking he's going to talk about Sorcerer when you said Star Wars.
Yeah.
I've never seen Sorcerer, but it's a remake of Wages of Fear.
Yes, it is.
By William Friedkin's remake of Wages of Fear.
Yeah. Now, I've got a bit of a connection with this film in the fact that a friend of mine and myself, there was three of us, no,
y'all transported explosives across a bridge?
Yeah, and then we went out and had some beer and we went and watched Sorcerer. But anyway...
Sweet!
Yeah, we did all that as well. But there was three of us one night. We went out to see Sorcerer. We said, hey, look, there's a... it was the 25th anniversary of the film. So there was a new print struck, and the theatre out here called the Astor Theatre plays a lot of... it's a revival theatre, pretty much. They don't really play new release stuff. And Sorcerer was on for I think it was a 1 week run or a 2 week run, something like that. But we went the first night and we watched the film, and everyone was like, you know, these trucks going over the bridge and filled with all these explosives. And everyone was flipping out because you have to understand, when we had the film here, we had the first 30 minutes cut out on VHS. The distribution company, in all their infinite wisdom, decided to cut the first 30 minutes out.
Don't you love it when those assholes do that?
Fucking pricks. And so the whole... those who had seen the VHS of Sorcerer when it was out here had missed the first 30 minutes. Their complete entire subplot was ripped. So the two-hour film now became, or the 110-minute film became pretty much an 80-85-minute film over here.
Oh, damn.
So the whole uncut version of this film had never been seen in this country. Like I said, a new print was struck, and it was shown. Film's done, yada, 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 credits come up, an announcement comes over the speaker, and now please welcome to the stage the director of the film, William Friedkin.
Oh,
he's
that's
in
cool.
the fucking audience. Can you believe it?
That's awesome.
And then his spotlight comes up, and guess what? The guy's two fucking rows away from me.
Oh, my gosh. That is so cool.
So he's...
Well, I'm a big fan of William Friedkin, too, so that's...
Yeah,
and that's really awesome.
So we had these plans to be home by, what, 9:30? We didn't get him till fucking midnight because Friedkin was on stage, and he was on there for 2 hours. Two and a half hours speaking afterwards.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, but the whole... irony is of this, I lent my copy of The Exorcist to a friend, and he was one of the friends we went to the movies with that night, and he said, "Stuart, got your copy of The Exorcist in the car." Okay.
That is awesome.
And guess what? Oh, by the way, Mr. Friedkin will be signing things in the auditorium after the speech.
Oh, that's...
Straight to the car, and I had a fucking silver texter in the car. I had a little container of texters and pens I keep with me, if I ever need to make a note or whatever. Straight to the car. I said, "Guys, I'll be back in 5 minutes." We'd parked. It was just literally just over the road. Straight to the car, grabbed the film, went back inside. And, I've got my signed copy of the Exorcist DVD and the flyer that was given out with Sorcerer as well. He signed that, and I've got that framed up in my house.
I am very jealous right now.
And let me tell you, he was actually quite a nice guy. I think time had mellowed the man out a bit because he was...
Oh, yeah. I've read all these horror stories about what a giant dick he was when he was at the top of his game. But apparently he has mellowed out a lot.
Yeah.
And apparently he is a sweet guy, loves to talk to fans, loves to, any director who's been around a while, he likes to talk about his work, especially stuff that no one saw at the time that's just now... getting an audience like Sorcerer.
Yeah, and the thing was, he was very moved that so many people come to see a film of his that was considered really a failure.
A flop. Yeah. Oh, man, it just got buried by Star Wars.
Oh, for sure. And the thing was that, the audience reaction of a film that was 25 years old was just like, people couldn't believe what they were seeing. And on the big screen, when it's projected on the big screen, it becomes a lot more grand. Than watching
yeah,
a small
like,
screen on a video.
I feel like Sorcerer is one of those films that got reviewed on its box office take
for
a while.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, because everyone I know who's seen it just heaps praise on it,
Oh, for sure.
And even says, like, it sort of outdoes parts of Wages of Fear.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen Wages of Fear, but a lot of people say the bridge sequences.
It's not as grand as Sorcerer's, no.
Well, a lot of people say the bridge sequence really, sort of outdoes the mud in Wages of Fear.
Oh, yeah. But when you've got this rickety old bridge and it's just swaying and swaying, you see these ropes coming apart and these planks falling off.
Yeah.
And with explosives in the back of the truck.
It's fucking...
Fucking crazy. What a film, Sorcerer. So I had to put it on there. Like I said, it was known, but it's not very well known.
It's one of those movies people have heard of, like me, but haven't seen,
You need to get schooled in Sorcerer quick.
Yeah, it's in my Netflix queue. I'm going to watch it.
Well, bump it up higher, because this is a hell of a film.
Yeah.
And the problem was, as well, a lot of people were saying, hey, what are we doing? We're going to see a special edition of Sorcerer? It's coming on DVD. Never came.
Yeah.
And this was back in 2002.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. If it's been that long, it's not
it's
coming.
It's been it,
yeah, Sorcerer, I feel like it's one of those movies that's just going to get lost.
The only hope I've got for it now is a Blu-ray release, because Friedkin's starting to go back to his catalog and do a lot of Blu-ray releases.
Blu-ray is the only hope right now we have.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because the DVD is even just full screen, I think, that's out here.
Yeah, I've got the DVD, and it doesn't quite match the scale of seeing it on the big screen or even a projected...
I had the opportunity, I almost bought it because I was on a big Friedkin kick, and I saw it used at a store, but the... I really have a hard time watching them. Like, if I'm watching, like, you know, a Chuck Norris movie or some, like, sort of something schlocky, you know, I'll watch it on full screen. In fact, yeah, I think it kind of adds to the appeal.
It doesn't really matter that much, but...
No, and it adds to the appeal, but if I'm watching something where the director is so visually adept like Friedkin, I really just can't do it. I want to see it in widescreen. I want to see the full shot, you know?
But if that's all you got, that's all you got for the time being. Why not see something?
I know. But yeah. I think there was something else I wanted to, and I just had X amount of dollars to spend, you know? So yeah. I was just like, well, I'm going to get this that's in widescreen and that I also want to see,
All right, so that's Sorcerer, one that's criminally underlooked, or overlooked, I should say, underseen, and needs to be watched.
Yes.
Including you, Hunter.
I know.
All right, over to you.
All right. Well, my next one is another one that's available from Criterion, but, you know, it's one that, you know, I think gets ignored by my generation. It's Roberto Rossellini's The Flowers of St. Francis.
Okay, I'm familiar with the title.
It's Roberto Rossellini is one of my favorite directors, and Flowers of St. Francis is of the films by him I've seen. I haven't seen all of his movies, but of the ones I've seen, it's my favorite. It's kind of got that Italian neorealist vibe going. It's in black and white. It's made in the 50s, and it's the entire cast is Don actors, except for one. There's one actor in the film.
Yep.
But it's about St. Francis and his group of monks, and it's all the monks are played by actual Franciscan monks. Mm-hmm. And it's all stories about Francis and his followers, and some of them are real, like there's like true stories, and some of them are ones that were kind of made up. Federico Fellini co-wrote the script, and you can definitely see his hand in parts of it.
Oh, okay.
But it's just a beautiful movie, though. Like, it doesn't really have, like, an overarching narrative so much as it is, like, a collection of short stories about these characters. But it's just, like, an amazing film. Like, I remember I saw it because I was at the video store with my dad, and it's this giant used video store in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad and I were just looking through it, and my dad just saw it on DVD sitting there, the Criterion Flowers of St. Francis. And Dad goes, "Hey, let's get this." And I was just like, "Okay." And so we took it home and watched it, and I just fell in love with it. But there's this great sequence in the film, though, and this is kind of the Fellini influence.
Yeah.
But there's one of Francis's followers, is a guy named Junipero, also known as Juniper in the West, and he's the namesake of a delicious breakfast restaurant here in Memphis called Brother Juniper's. But there's this bit where Junipero goes out to preach the gospel, and Francis says that Junipero talks too much, and he said, "I will let you go preach on your own, but before you preach, I want you to say, 'I talk and I talk, but I say very little.'"
Mm-hmm.
And so Junipero goes out to preach, and he basically discovers that there is a barbarian army that is ravaging the countryside, and so he decides he's going to go find this army and preach to them. And he goes to he finds this barbarian army, and they're kind of cutting up in the woods. Yeah. And he goes up to them, and he goes, "I talk and I talk," and before he can finish his sentence, they just bum rush him and pick him up and start tossing him around like a little doll. Like, they would go, "Hey!" And they just start throwing him. And you would swear this monk was an acrobat, because it's so – they pick him up. A pair of barbarians will pick him up by his hands and his feet and go, "Woo!" and toss him. And another group will catch him. And they'll just go, "Rah, rah."
Sounds like the Ayatollah's funeral, it does.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And so the barbarian leader is like, "Bring him here." And this guy's the only real actor in the film.
Yep.
And he's this bug-eyed guy with these enormous lips and this giant mustache. I mean, this is the Fellini influence. And he's in this giant black suit of armor with spikes. And just like, it's the most evil-looking suit of armor, but then you see him inside it, and it's so impractical that he can't move in it.
Yeah.
He's in this suit of armor, and he can't move inside it at all. And he's trying to look at Ginepro, and he's looking out of any hole he can in the armor because there's too much room. It's too big, and he can't get out, and he has to have all this help to get into it.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of this guy trying to look big, evil, and scary, but really he just looks ridiculous. and he's like, you know, we're going to kill this guy, you know, this fool who comes to talk to us. But he gets a little one-on-one session with Ginepro, and he, like, really wants to beat the shit out of him. Like, he looks at him, and it's like, I really want to hurt you, but I somehow can't bring myself to do it because you're so sweet-looking.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, Ginepro looks at him, and it's like, how can you punch this face? And so eventually he just is like, well, we're getting out of here, and he takes his army and leaves.
Yep.
And it's just sort of the idea of innocence as a weapon. But it's just the movie's full of just delightful little tales like that. But yeah, it's out on Criterion. If you like Italian cinema, if you like neorealism, if you're at all, if you held any Christian values, it's an amazing film.
Okay.
So I adore it.
And it's from the 60s, you said? Was it or 50s?
No, 50s.
50s, all right, right. Yeah.
It's an amazing movie, though. It's one of my favorite films.
All right, nice. Okay, well, I'm going to go all the way back to the year I was born, 1971, and it's a little film starring a unknown actor at the time, Al Pacino, and the film is The Panic in Needle Park.
I've heard of this.
It's got Kitty Wynn, Al Pacino, and...
Isn't it about heroin junkies?
It's absolutely about heroin junkies in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And how they all band together, and the only thing they have in common is the heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And also about the descent of the character by Kitty Wynn, I believe her name is Helen in the film, and how she shacks up with Pacino, and Pacino's already a wreck. He's strung out in the drug, and she becomes worse, and she tries, and she becomes worse and worse and worse, and then she becomes, you know, pretty much like a zombie, you know, the Walking Dead. And I mean, it's got some stellar performances by De Niro and Kitty Wynn, but the standout performance is Raul Julia as Marco.
Oh, wow. I didn't know Raul Julia was in it.
Oh, man. It's not... His performance is not over-amped, or it's not overwrought, or anything like that, but it's a very reserved performance, but a very chilling performance as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I really... I mean, that's an actor I miss greatly, is Raul Julia. What a loss.
That's my Netflix cue.
At it now, but yeah, Panic in Needle Park. That was one I had to get off cable from years ago. It only got a release, I think, about 2 or 3 years ago on DVD. And at the time that I got it off cable, which was about the early 2000s, the VHS of it was going on eBay for, I think I saw one go for $200.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was that hard to get. And then it finally got a DVD release. And thankfully it did, because now this film can be seen... And you could see the emergence of a real screen presence in Pacino, which I believe this performance led him to get The Godfather.
Yeah, I think it was definitely pre-Godfather.
Oh, it was. This is the performance that Coppola saw that got him the spot of Michael Corleone.
Yeah. I've always wanted to see Panic in Needle Park, so I'm going to have to put a rush on that and see it.
Yeah. But and the end as well, very, very sad ending. It just... This shows you that...
Do these movies ever end well, these drug movies?
Oh, they never could. They never mm-hmm. could. But the destruction of the person, of the human being by a drug is just, I mean...
Yeah.
It's tough to watch. I mean, very mm-hmm. hard to watch.
And since this movie comes out of this it's from the 70s, it's very... it's probably presented in a more interesting way than it... Otherwise,
it's graphic. I believe, from what I've read, this is the first film ever to show a graphic injection of a drug into an arm.
Right. Yeah, like, I mean, because Sinatra played a heroin addict in Man with the Golden Arm, but I don't think it's any... I don't think they give you that real... No. I don't think you'll see him shooting up. You just see him going into withdrawal and, like, you know, and it's really kind of overdone, I think.
It's nothing like Panic in Needle Park. This is some shocking stuff. Probably not so shocking today compared to what we've had thrown us the last 30 years or so, but
yeah, like it would probably been back then to what, like, you know, Requiem for a Dream is today or something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, cool. Panic in Needle Park. Have to check it out.
Please do.
Okay, so we're down to my last one.
Yeah.
And this one's a good film, and it's a good film. Of course, it's a good film. Otherwise, why the fuck would I be talking about it? It's a documentary called Heavy Metal in Baghdad.
Sam Dunn?
No, Sam Dunn. You're thinking of Global Metal.
Okay, no,
I love Sam Dunn, though. Sam Dunn's a badass. He did Heavy Metal, A Headbanger's Journey, and
that's
Global
the one
Metal,
I'm thinking of. Yeah,
Rush
yeah.
Beyond the Lighted Stage and Iron Maiden Flight 666.
I've got that one, yeah.
I love me some Sam Dunn, but no, Sam didn't do this movie.
Okay.
Heavy Metal in Baghdad, it's a documentary about a band in Baghdad called Kraus Cicada.
Yep.
And they're supposedly, like, you know, the only or one of the only heavy metal bands in Iraq. And it kind of tells their story beginning, like, right before the invasion of Iraq to sort of the middle of that conflict, sort of in the heat of it all.
Yep.
And, you know, these filmmakers, it's a film made over a very long period of time, because the filmmakers will go over there and they have to kind of track these guys down, which isn't easy.
Yep.
They kind of track them down and, you know, get some stuff, and then they will lose touch with them for a few years, and then, you know, get back in touch with them a few years later and retrack down a bunch of them. And at one point, like, they left Iraq, and I can't remember where they went, but, you know, they get to meet up with them in some other city where they're living a different life. But the reason I like this movie, and it, I'm a big fan of heavy metal. It's my favorite genre of music. It's, you know, I know you're a big metalhead too, Stu.
Yeah, I am.
you were a fan of Anvil before the movie, but
long before the movie.
Yeah. So, but the reason I really like this movie, though, is it really lets you. It really takes something as simple as music and puts it out in front of us and says, look at how good we've got it. You know, look at these things we take for granted, the ability to listen to music,
yep.
The ability to play music, the music we want. Because, like, one of the guys in the band they meet with, and they meet with him, like, in Iraq in the middle of this conflict. And, you know, getting in touch with them is a pain in the ass, and they can't go very far with him.
Yep.
But he's wearing, like, a Slipknot shirt,
oh, wow.
I think. And he says, like, you know, wearing this shirt could get me killed.
Killed, yeah. He's like,
but I just don't give a shit anymore. He goes, saying that. He said, wearing this shirt could get me killed. He goes, anything could get me killed out here. But he says, it's just another thing, you know, that could get me killed. But he's just saying, like, you know, extremists might kill him for listening to this music or having anything. But wearing metal shirts is a good way to get yourself killed by some of those Islamic groups.
Oh, completely, yeah.
It just sort of it's a really rough around the edges movie, and that's because its subject matter is so hard to document, especially when they were making the film.
Is that mentioned in the film exactly how the subject came about to actually start documenting this band?
I can't remember. I think there was an article about them right before the invasion,
right,
in some magazine, and this documentarian decided he was going to go meet with them, and then their practice space got bombed out.
Jeez.
and like, you know, their status as a band is very off and on. Like, they document their first show, then their practice space gets destroyed, and they sort
let me ask you something. Did they get much of a crowd in their first show? I mean, you'd be such a
they got like a nice small group of kids. Like, it's like a group of, like, you know, 20-25 kids.
Okay.
And then, you know, they reform later in another city outside of Iraq to do a show, and even still, it's still kind of dangerous out there, but they do a show to a little bigger crowd. But it's kind of like anybody who's into that music just sort of comes, and it's, you know, a very small group, but it's just about these guys sort of exercising this freedom that they don't have.
Yep.
And how difficult it is to do that, whereas we take that stuff for granted over here.
Yep.
And it's just sort of it's sort of eye opening in how you don't even have to like heavy metal to enjoy this movie.
Yeah. It's a loss of freedom of choice.
They play covers. They've got a few, they've got a few, like, original songs, but they mostly play covers and stuff. But it's just the freedom to listen to and enjoy and express yourself And we have that here in the America, and I'm sure in Australia as well.
Yeah.
And whereas in the Middle East,
you don't have that choice.
Really don't. And these guys are doing it anyway, but they're doing it at great risk to themselves. But at the same time, but that just makes it even more interesting.
You got to wonder as well, if these guys do ever get killed, I hope they don't, but if they get killed.
Actually, they haven't, because I think like this movie, I think around the time the movie came out, they managed to secure visas to the U.S.
Oh, okay. That's so good.
I think they live in the Northeast now.
Oh, good. I was going to say, if they ever got killed over there, would they become martyrs?
Yeah, no, they made it out of there. They made it out of there after the movie was completed.
Oh, cool.
The movie ends with them living in.
Don't tell me.
Sorry.
I want to go. I'm actually going to rent it out.
Yeah. Okay. So, right. but you know, but they don't show it in the movie, but they do make it to the U.S.
Okay. Good.
They
stuff.
They did make it to the U.S.
Good.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm down to my last one as well, and this is more, again, one that's overshadowed, which is kind of overlooked, but the director involved is so huge that, and he's got such a small body of work, it's kind of not overlooked. And with a film of his called Star Wars, I'm going to go all the way back to his first one, THX-1138.
The only movie you've mentioned that I've seen.
Yeah. I just think this film is so radical.
It's hard sci-fi too.
Oh yeah.
It's not like Star Wars where it's space opera. I mean, this is real science fiction.
This it is. And the thing is, while people really tend to forget just how creative George Lucas could be. I mean, you look at his short films. I think he's got one called Freiheit, and there's one called I forgot the other one as well, which is about the car.
I forget the name of it. It's like the name of the car, and it's a bunch of numbers. I don't remember.
And it's and also the original short for THX, which was THX-1138 EB4.
Wasn't it called Electric Labyrinth THX-1138?
Oh, was it? It could be. Yeah, I know.
George Lucas loved those long ass titles with lots of numbers in them.
Yeah, but he's THX-1138 is. I find Lucas at his most creative. His most original.
And
Star Wars is original, but it's also based on that Kurosawa film.
Star Wars is an original creation, but it's borrowing, like a lot of great films, it's borrowing from Saturday, it's borrowing from serials, it's borrowing from The Hero's Journey, it's borrowing from Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress.
That's it, Hidden Fortress.
It's borrowing from a lot of different sources, but it's a space opera, it's a fantastical adventure, and it changed cinema forever.
It did.
THX-1138, however, is hard sci-fi. That's definitely a film of that era, before Star Wars. The pre-Star Wars era of American cinema, where movies are really sort of bleak and dark and strange.
Oh, this is a miserable little movie, this one. I mean,
it's got Robert Duvall and Donald Pleasence in it.
Yes, it does.
Given this movie the special edition treatment.
But with this film as well, you first watch the credit sequence at the start. It's got credits, and they come down. They don't come up. They come down.
Yes, they do.
And you see that, and you think, I'm in for something really different here. And then... Mm-hmm. It comes up, and the first thing you hear is that, what's wrong? And you think, we're on a journey, we're on a trip here. And you are for 90 minutes. This is, I shout the praise of this film. I think THX-1138 is just astounding. What a movie. What a film.
Yeah, it's a really interesting movie. It's a very, you know, I don't know, a lot of people like to.
It's got that Orwellian feel to it with 1984.
Oh, it's definitely got that 1984 Brave New World totalitarian society thing going on. Yeah, did you see the movie Fanboys?
No, I've not seen it yet.
Well, you know what it's about, yeah?
Yeah.
Those kids who break into the Lucas Ranch. But the security guards at the Lucas Ranch look like the cops from THX-1138.
Oh, you're kidding.
Isn't that awesome?
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I've got to see that.
And the leader of them is played by Danny McBride, which is awesome.
Nice. Okay, with the DVD of THX-1138 as well, you've got the special edition. Now, a lot of people haven't been happy with George Lucas and his revisionism with his films on DVD, especially, as we know, Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope.
We're about to get Star Wars in 3D.
No thanks.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. But anyway, THX-1138 totally benefits from having a special edition.
I agree. I really like – and plus, like, the original version was really tampered with by the studio. Yes. Like, they recut the movie. They put the scenes out of sequence. They just messed with it. George Lucas was devastated by it. That's the movie that, like, made George Lucas kind of the rebel he is that works outside the system.
Yes.
Because the studios really messed with him on THX, and they recut his movie. And – Lucas kind of went into exile after that, and then he came and destroyed Hollywood with Star Wars.
Well, he did American Graffiti a few years later.
He did American Graffiti first, but Star Wars, you know, totally, like, you know, took Hollywood over, and it was, and, you know, well,
that was his plan of attack, really, Star Wars was. I mean, he did American Graffiti, and he, you know, got that out of the way sort of thing, but Star Wars was his real, you know, his master plan.
And American Graffiti, too, really kicked off the whole, like, 50s nostalgia craze.
Oh, completely,
like,
yeah.
Like, if it wasn't for Star Wars – I mean, American Graffiti, we never would have gotten, you know, Happy Days and stuff like that.
No, absolutely not, no. But THX 1138 is the one where I always to run back to, and I just think that it's so overlooked. It's criminally overlooked, and I kind of resent Star Wars for it, but I can't resent Star Wars because, I mean, he didn't plan to have – sci-fi film overshadow his first sci-fi film.
No, and, you know, it was messed with, but he eventually put it out there for people to see.
Oh, boy, did he do that, yeah.
Like, I mean, Lucas, he put it out there for everyone to see again and put it out his way. And, you know, bravo for bringing it back out there.
Well, with me, THX is always the one film that'll get him off the hook. I mean, I can't. You know, with the film thugs, I can't completely divorce George Lucas.
I can't divorce George Lucas either, and it's because Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back are so special to me.
With me, it's THX. I mean, I'm always...
Oh, I love THX, too, but, you know, I don't know. Star Wars is just magical. The original first film, and it's just magical to me. I love it. But it's not like... I don't consider it to be really science fiction. And
no.
If I tell people, if you want to see George Lucas do sci-fi, like real sci-fi,
yeah.
THX 1138.
Absolutely, yeah. Great film. All right, well, that's everything. That's... not every film we find to be overlooked, but it's the one we...
No, I had like a list of like 20 that I whittled down.
I had a few more, but I mean, we won't go over those. We've picked out the ones we want. We've basically given you a broad idea. I mean, I've given you ones back from as far back as the late 60s. You've done back from the 50s right up to last year. So we've sort of covered the generations or the ages, if you will.
Yes. We've covered quite a few bases here.
In our own way, yes.
Yeah. All right, so, well, that's it for us today. The Overlooked Hotel, Profiles in Obscurity.
Yep.
And you can reach us at www.midnightmoviecowboys.com.
Yep.
You can email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com.
Yep. Start sending us some emails as well, guys and girls, because we do want to hear from you. We are really big on getting feedback, voicemails, particularly. If we get voicemails from you guys and girls out there, we are definitely going to put them in the show.
We'll put them in the show. If you've got a voicemail for us, send us your voicemails. Send it to us on an MP3 with your emails. And also leave us feedback on the site, too, because you can leave comments. Some people are very good about doing that with the last show. But seriously, like, giving us feedback, giving us comments, like post on the Facebook page. You can reach us on Facebook. Just search Midnight Movie Cowboys. Follow us on Twitter at MM Cowboys.
Yep.
If you've got Twitter, but just get in touch with us. Tweet at us, post on our Facebook page, send us emails, comment on the website, whatever your preferred method of contact is, because we love to hear from you all.
Yep.
It just, like, you know, when you do shows like this, you sort of don't know who's listening, if they're enjoying it, if they like it. That's so give us a shout. Let us know. Leave us a review on iTunes. Let us know what you think we're doing well. If you've got any constructive criticism, we'd love to hear it.
Yes. Especially the iTunes factor. We had a bit of a headache getting ourselves onto iTunes, but that is
now... Yes, we are on iTunes now. You can search for us and you can subscribe. So go to iTunes and subscribe if you haven't.
And leave us a review. That would be most appreciated. I would also like to say to everybody out there who did listen to Episode Zero, all the guys out there who gave us shout-outs in their podcasts, I'm going to get to all those guys in a minute because I am not going to leave this show without mentioning some people.
The outpouring of support has been overwhelming.
Fucking incredible. I just...
I mean, from the podcasting community, community.
All the people on Facebook who came to our page, hit the like button, became fans of the show. We thank every one of you, all the ones out there who have gone to iTunes and subscribed or gone to the website and given us hits and comments and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we thank everyone. When we started this venture, we didn't know what the fuck we were getting ourselves into. But to have people, I mean, I've been checking the stats on the website, and we're getting hits in North America, United Kingdom, Sweden, Hong Kong. I believe there was one out there, and
Japan.
I think Japan was actually Hong Kong. You know me with geography. I'm shit ass, but yes, so everybody who's done all that, we are so appreciative. Spread the word. Go tell your boyfriend. Go tell your girlfriends. Go tell your mums, dads, your grandmas. Everybody, hit everybody up. We are on Facebook, Hunter and myself. You want to friend us? Yeah, by all means. Don't let our photos scare you.
We're very friendly. Stu's got his Budweiser face on in his new one. I changed it last night.
Yeah, I changed it from great. The Divine one, yeah.
We just want to give some thank yous real quick.
Yes, we have to.
Andy from the Hollywood Saloon, just apropos of nothing, like we didn't ask him or anything, he made this great artwork for us that we have on our Facebook page and our website and our Twitter that he just did for us out of the goodness of his heart. And that's like the such a major thing for me because I've been such a fan of the Saloon for so long.
Me too, yeah. And for Andy to turn around, I mean, he just hit us both up at the same time with our Facebook inbox and said, pretty much, hey guys, I was just playing around in Photoshop. I was bored and I've done you this. I thought, if you can do that when you're bored, God help us what you can do when you actually put your mind to it. If you're doing
what Andy can do. We've seen.
I mean, the graphics on the site are just astonishing. And I saw that. I was flipping out.
Me too. I was so excited. I mean, it's just been overwhelming. And you know, Derek Shadowens has been giving us pointers of the film.
I was speaking to Derek for about an hour and a half, and he gave me some really, really important tips on equipment that we are planning to pick up because
We definitely plan on upgrading our mics.
Yes, we will sound a lot better in the future. And Derek gave me some very, very valuable editing tips, which I am going to pass on to Hunter when he starts the editing process. And by the way, thanks for that, Derek. We do owe you one big. Derek's over at the filmflimflam.webs.com. He's on iTunes as well. Andy Sims is on the hollywoodsaloon.com, and they're in iTunes, and you should be over there. Anyways,
it's the best podcast around.
It is the best one around.
Well, and I want to give a big thank you to Jim Dirks from the Film Thugs movie show. I recently filled in for Clarkson Campbell over there, and Jim had me on, and we did a show on IMDb's top 20 festival breakouts list, and it was a great show.
Very funny show.
Yeah, it just went up the other day, and it's a lot of fun, and it gave us ample opportunity to, you know, let ourselves be known to his audience.
And Jim, if you're listening, fuck Fosters. Those who have heard the show will know what I'm talking about.
But go listen to the Film Thugs. It's a great show.
Definitely. And I want to give one more shout out to Mr. Rick Gutierrez over at the United States of Geekdom. Rick gave me, well, us really, some very good pointers with the website and just plugging our shit on his show. Yep. And I mean, we're really thankful for anyone who plugs our show. And yeah, Rick was out there, you know, spruking our name. And we are very thankful for that. And Rick's over at the United States of Geekdom.com. They're in iTunes as well. Go check them out. That is a fun, fun show.
Yeah, I was listening to their show last week. I listened to all their episodes and I enjoyed it immensely. So.
It is a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for us this time around. Come episode 2, we've got a topic. We've actually got a few topics lined up for the next set of shows. I think from, 2 to 6 or 7, we've got topics lined up. So we're actually going to be a lot more focused. It won't be, we like this film, check it out, or this is my favorite film. We're actually going to be topic-based for the next few episodes and the ones after that. And
it's not going to be lists that we're blind to each other.
No. It'll be actual topical shows. So from now on as well, episode 2 onward will be with the bells and whistles, you know, music, clips, all that sort of stuff.
A little more topical. They'll require a lot more prep.
Yep, they will be. Okay. Well, we better sign off.
All right. I'm Hunter Deucing.
And I'm Stuart Bulk. a.k.a. Stu.
All right. Catch y'all guys later.
See you guys. Bye.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping, staring. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows.